the British Empire and the French Republic, linked together in their cause and in their need, will defend to the death their native soil, aiding each other like good comrades to the utmost of their strength. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
GlobalRecon.net, giving you the matter of facts. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. I'm out with Chantel Taylor, British Army combat medic and author of the book Battle Won. Chantel, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, John?
It's good. Everything is good. How's everything?
Yeah, it's been an interesting week.
Yeah, definitely. So the guest who was on for this week's episode is Foxy. He's pretty well known in the UK. He's a former British Special Boat Service operator, which is the British equivalent of SEAL Team 6. It's their counterterrorism naval unit. And Foxy was in the Marines for 20 years, the British Royal Marines for 20 years, and then half of that time was spent in the SBS as a Special Forces operator. And you and Foxy actually know each other, which is interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, we've known each other for a couple of reasons, I guess. Initially, I met Foxy when we were filming the first season of the SAS Who Dares Wins sort of reality show. And I covered the kind of no-duff medic, that sort of side of it. So, you know, the time when they did the sort of outdoor activities, including the fan dance and all those types of things, I would position myself to obviously deal with any casualties that were actually happening. We had a little team of us. So, and that's when I first met Foxy. And I didn't realize, it's interesting, actually, because on my final tour of Afghan, we had two JTACs attached to our fighting company, and they were both Special Boat Service, and one of them, Andy, was the following year. I mean, this guy was outstanding, and at some points, I didn't cover too much on him in my book because obviously at that time, you know, you don't write about SF guys on the ground. And unfortunately, a year later, Andy was killed. It was a really successful raid, I believe. And again, it's not overwhelmingly kind of documented, but by all accounts, he was a super operator. And just from my own experience of him, many of the guys that I'd worked with, the young infantry soldiers, they kind of patrolled harder because of him, because he would not hesitate in dropping munitions. And there was even an incident, I think it was covered in another book, called Code Black. And I remember I was in the ops room when this happened. And when I say ops room, this is in our patrol base. So it was all kind of, the ops room kind of was right next door to the RAP and stuff like that. And Andy came in, and our brigade commander's call sign came up on the net, and was like, shit, that's quite a big deal for that to happen because of the amount of munitions being dropped. But bearing in mind at that time in Nadi Ali, you know, we were we were on a kind of a mission that developed extremely quickly. And he would just, he was the guy on the ground. And that's exactly what he said. You know, I'm the guy on the ground, so I make the decision. So all of a sudden you've got all these grunts. I've got this major crush on this JTAC because he was, whenever they were in trouble, he'd get them out of it really, you know. So when you think about those things, and I spoke to Foxy about this, I said, you know, it's strange because I think the military community, you all know somebody, and it kind of links everyone in. And when I found that out, I said to Foxy, I said, it's, you know, when he was killed that year later, because of the way tours move and people just go off, they get flown out, someone new gets flown in, you know, no one really had the time to tell him how grateful they were, you know. And I can say as the company medic that he saved an awful lot of soldiers from getting killed. So if that's his legacy and potentially you can talk about it now that he's gone, then I don't think there's any shame in that because, yeah, they sign up to this kind of this agreement, and of course as they should. But yeah, Andy deserves to be spoken about. So he was a little bit of a legend in the infantry fighting company that I'd serve with. So, and obviously that was one of the things that had affected Foxy quite badly when he had that chronic sort of fatigue and ended up having to leave. So, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, I think obviously for that community, the British Special Forces community, and then, of course, here in the States and any kind of Western nation where they have their counterterrorism operators, you know, deploying and fighting, you know, a large portion of, or if not all of what they do is pretty much kept secret and for good reason. But for certain units at times, there is some positive in being able to talk about, you know, some of their fallen brothers and that kind of thing. And just to set us, you know, even if it's just a little bit of light on some of the work that they do, you know, at the same time maintaining that operational security, that personal security kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, and even when you hear, like, it's good to hear things that have potentially gone in the past, so long as you don't start giving too much away. But you know, there are, I think, a lot of things are open source anyway nowadays because the training, I'm sure, like, it develops, but the ethos and stuff obviously stays the same from when, you know, the days of the sort of forefathers, you know. So that's where it all comes from. So and definitely I think that people, especially the fallen, it's great that they're honored, and it's great to hear about them because, like I said, he had a massive influence on the battle space in our area for sure. And then you could even go to the realms of saying if he hadn't have been there and had the attitude that he did, you know, who knows what would have happened. You know, if you have someone there that doesn't have that attitude and that kind of does what they're told, and I don't like to say that, like, but they kind of just fit in this little box and do, then, you know, a whole world of pain could have come down on the blokes that were patrolling. So yeah, I'm certainly grateful to have had him for the time that we did.
Yeah, and I actually, it's interesting because when you think of British Special Forces, at least as an American, immediately you think of the SAS, right? The kind of, you know, the very famous legendary unit. Even though the SBS has been around for the same period of time, and you know, they fought in World War II as well. But I remember reading a book by a retired Delta Force Major, Dalton Fury, who passed away last year. And he was the ground commander when they were going after Bin Laden in Tora Bora in 2001. And in his book, he was talking about how there was a few Army Special Forces teams there, Green Berets.
Yeah,
there were some CIA teams there. Delta was there. And then he said the British had sent SBS commandos. And I remember reading that. I'm like, who the fuck are SBS commandos?
Is that what you said? Who the fuck?
That's exactly what I said. And then I did some little bit of research on it. And I'm like, wow, this is pretty interesting. And I got this book written by this guy. He was in, I believe, in the 70s. Mid-70s, he got in the mid-70s or late 70s and served through, I believe, the 90s.
Yeah.
And it was just kind of like eye opening to learn about this unit that is, you know, a tier one unit, but it's not the SAS. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I suppose that then, you know, the way it is now, they all do the same initial selection, and then they obviously go off and do what's classes their areas of expertise. But in the way that the world is, I think that both have equal roles in the world, don't they? They have their right. different, they go off and do their different things, but the goal at the end's the same, isn't it? So, and I don't think, yeah, there's not a great deal of literature on the SBS, is there?
No, there really isn't. I mean, just a small handful of books, you know, but I guess that's good, you know, for the unit, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and even the stuff that's out, the literature that's out on the Special Air Service, it's still limited, and that's no bad thing.
Right, and what's actually interesting about the Special Air, I mean, I guess UK Special Forces in general is, from the last 15 years, there isn't much of any literature out, kind of.
No.
I mean, you have some stuff that was written by journalists, kind of documenting.
But I think that's the rule, John, actually. I'm sure that you can never confirm. Because I had that when my book went through MOD clearance, and any sign of, you know, because they can't sort of confirm that they're either operating here or there. And I think that's the rule. I don't quote me on that, but I'm pretty sure that there's a rule that you can't say, you know, you could basically see five dudes and think, you know, but you can't actually confirm that that's them. I'm not too sure that must be the way it is. Yeah.
No, it might be, because there's really not much about what they've been up to, you know.
And
like I said, that's a good thing. But you know, aside from that, there has been a lot going on this week.
Yeah. Shit. Well, and it sort of lends itself. So Afghanistan, if you stay on that subject, the old Moab.
Yeah. And so basically, the Moab is the largest. The bomb
that non-nuclear,
has the most,
isn't it? Yeah.
Right. It has the most destructive power outside of a nuclear bomb in the U.S. arsenal. And I believe it was the first time it was ever used. And a Green Beret was killed in the same area that they dropped the bomb a few days before it happened. And apparently ISIS fighters were using this cave, and they had like this tunnel network, and they were kind of filtering in and out through these tunnels. And what they ended up doing was dropping the Moab directly on the mountain. And initially they said like 35 guys were killed, 35 ISIS fighters were killed. And then the numbers went up to like north of 100. And so it really dealt them a blow. And I would imagine a psychological blow as well.
And it has. You know, I'd spent 2 years in Nangarhar province after my military service, and in Jabad actually. And that's a real sort of a place that the Taliban, you know, they often use it. It's their main thoroughfare in and out of Pakistan. And also I think they use that as a little bit of a holiday destination. Clearly, if they were using that area as a holiday destination, that potentially got a little bit dark.
Right.
Last week. But that's the thing. And you do need to make a dent in their morale too, because I speak about that. I spoke about Afghanistan in us pulling out, the Brits, and obviously it was sort of a bit misconstrued, but my point initially is if you leave a vacuum, it's going to be filled. And all of these places, and you've got Afghanistan, you've got all these places in Africa, you know, Somalia, Mali, Algeria, Libya, they all become vacuums and sort of havens for people to either regroup and then, you know, launch assaults in all these different areas. So it's good. I think it's a positive move. And I see that Karzai came out today and condemned it. I mean, he came, you know, it was all very poetic.
Yeah.
But I think
I think Karzai is a smart guy, but I think, you know, there is a bit of politics that he plays in kind of serving in his own interest.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, it is always, it's very self-serving. And that's where you kind of lose. So any sincerity, it kind of it's diminished, because you just think, well, hang on. It's so random that it came out there's nothing sort of concrete. There's no facts behind it. It's just thoughts and feelings, as opposed to actually backing it up with facts. And I don't think he was overly helpful during you know, certain times, especially times that I've been in Afghanistan on a different sort of level. So,
right. Because, you know, there's, you know, obviously in war, there are issues with civilians getting killed or, you know, civilians claiming they were mistreated on raids or, you know, that kind of thing. But
yeah, this has been classed as quite a big success on that level where they weren't.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There
hasn't, from what I understand, there hasn't been any reported civilian casualties. And I think part of that is because it was in a cave complex, you know, like a bit away from everything. But, I mean, I know a guy by the name of Justin Charters who he puts out a lot of articles and does a lot of great work at the Independent Journal Review. They're like an online publication. And he was interviewing people who were in the area at the time the bomb was dropped. And basically from his articles, what you come to understand is that ISIS kind of been stepping on these people's necks for a while now.
Yeah.
And they're kind of happy that they're kind of getting the screws put to them, you know?
Yeah, because that's the thing with these groups. It's not like when we talk about civilian casualties, you know, these groups don't treat the local populace very good at all. You know, there's not it's not a time to be, you know, you don't want to be around those groups. It's not a good way to live. And looking down south where we've had places like Sangin have fallen back into the hands of the Taliban, that's not a good deal for the local people.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because any instances that are documented where some sort of terror group or, you know, very right-wing kind of jihadi type of ideological group, anytime that they are governing someplace versus trying to, you know, be rebels and fight the government or whatever it is, they fail miserably because they follow the rules that they follow are so strict and like literally, you know, rules that are hundreds of years old, thousands of years old that really just don't fit in today's world with most people, you know?
Yeah, so and
eventually the people are going to turn against that kind of constriction, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Or they'll start, you know, testing their own produce, which is probably what happens in Afghanistan a lot.
Yeah.
You know, that's why almost the entire country are high. You know, it's not a good, under the rule of the Taliban, it's not a great place to be, is it? Or ISIS, you know, or groups in and around those.
Right, because it's all, I mean, you know, they might have different names or something, but
they're all the same much of a muchness, aren't they?
Yeah.
And then, I've also looked, you know, been doing a bit of research this week on the old North Korea incident. You know, what's how's that looking your end, John?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's the U.S. sent a fleet to the Korean Peninsula, and then the Japanese Navy sent some ships along with it. Now, apparently, the Russian and Chinese, like, intelligence-gathering ships are tailing them, like, tracking their movements. And Mike Pence, the VP of the United States, Vice President, he took an unannounced trip to the DMZ, the border between North Korea and South Korea. And he kind of broke security protocol and was, I guess, either talking from a point that they didn't want him to be at, or he just walked up to this point where he was like less than 100 feet from North Korean soldiers.
Yeah.
And basically he said something to the effect of, we want to resolve this peacefully and diplomatically. But at the same time, he kind of said, like, we're ready in a sense. So.
And it's almost that there's an awful lot of posturing going on. You know, I don't know how true it is, but they had the vice foreign minister of North Korea saying that, and this is the strangest thing. So he was talking, said if the US reacted, then North Korea would take a preemptive strike. Now, and I don't know if I'm wrong, but in my head, preemptive means it's before, surely. But that was the word. And I thought, well, but, you know, that kind of moved on. But there's posturing from everybody, and I almost feel like everyone wants to have their little say. You know, I'll just chime in. I'm going to pipe up and maybe I'll send a ship. You know, it's And then you've got, so the Russians, the Chinese and the Japanese are all condemning it, but then they almost want to get involved so they don't look weak. And
right. Like, well, I think the best course of action would be to resolve it diplomatically, because.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I mean,
you know, people, and you see it on social media, you know, everyone's talking tough, like, yeah, you know, fuck them and this and that. But at the end of the day, if war breaks out with a country like North Korea, it's not going to be
like Iraq or Afghanistan.
It's going to be like attrition, you know, like thousands and thousands of thousands
It's almost like that. Who doesn't mind? And they say this, that war of attrition is who doesn't mind, like, so almost regardless of how many you kill, we'll keep going.
Exactly.
It's that kind of hideous.
Right.
And that then you're talking in the hundreds of thousands. That's not just, you know, at the moment, every obviously, clearly, every soldier counts. But when you look at those numbers, it's like, well, hang on.
Yeah, it's not even close.
Yeah, I mean, the world, doesn't need to see that again.
Exactly. I mean, Iraq and Afghanistan, a lot of people died. But in comparison, I mean, like.
To the Great Wars.
Yeah, not even close. I mean, 20,000 people died. In a couple of days' time after they took the beaches at Normandy.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, like, the morning of the Battle of the Somme, I think it was, that's definitely into double figures, if not in potentially around 29, 30,000.
Yeah, and this is just...
And that's in one morning, yeah.
Right, and there were several instances of these type of numbers of people being killed, and that is a whole another level of warfare.
And that's when countries start. That's not, but having said that, you know, North Korea, the sanctions haven't just been made by the US. You know, there's been a sort of outcry by the useful UN, you know, but so that it's not a case of the North Korea against the US. They're kind of making it a bit like that, I feel. And this isn't from a US perspective. This is, I feel like North Korea is saying to America, no, but it's not just the Americans saying stop with the missile testing.
Right. I mean, even from what I understand, China to some degree,
they did exactly the same. And the only people that they're sort of concentrating their efforts, or they're kind of gobbing off, if you like, is at the Americans. So it's sort of provoking a reaction, or let's see how far we can push. But that's not the stuff to be kind of provoking, is it?
Right.
Nuclear bombs, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Because at the end of the day, if a war does break out, obviously, you know, they can say whatever they want, but the American military is a tremendous force in the world. And
it will defend itself. You know, it's not going to say, hell, okay, we'll see how your targets go. I was looking, interestingly, at the scope of the ranges of their missiles, and I don't know whether I was correct in seeing that it missed the UK. Is that a good thing that we're so small, John?
Yeah, maybe.
That, you know, we picked the island for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
Because there's far larger targets around us.
Oh yeah, for sure. And
while all this is going on, actually, Europe's been rather quiet, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And
the only thing that I've seen in the news are they're now saying that the concentration camps are now becoming execution camps for homosexuals in Chechnya.
In Chechnya, yeah.
Yeah, I know, but it's almost like. It's quite hard to believe that that's just, you know, it's in the news, and it's almost because of the way we are now with social media, people will just ride past that article because there'll be something more interesting. Oh, all right, so homosexuals are being murdered in Chechnya. Well, what's, you know?
Right, that's, it's just like swipe, it's kind of, swipe down, what's the next
yeah,
thing? Right?
What's next? Yeah, so that's nuts. But then I did see it was a lovely story, but very sad as well. Is that the oldest person in the world died this week?
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yes, yeah,
she was
like the
Italian lady
who was born in the 1800s or something.
Yeah, in the 18th century. Yeah, the Italian lady. So I thought it was 117.
Yeah, that's old. I mean, she lived like a huge transformation in the world. You know.
Yeah, and I thought that's quite extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Anything else? Oh, I did see that Trump, I don't want to mention the news thing, but he's now got his own subcategory on you know, like you've got like BBC Sky, and so you have this like the subcategory, so you have like UK News World, and then you've got Trump now. So he's got his own subtitle.
Oh yeah, I mean people are talking everything he does. I know. I mean, he's a president, but everything he does is like talked about, you know, tremendously. But
yeah, so I just thought it was quite comical. So but he's, and I see Russia came out and said that there's a new level of mistrust with the US after the strikes in Syria.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just for Russia's information, nobody trusts the Russians either way. So.
Yeah, I know. And it's been that's been going on for quite a few years now.
Yeah, I mean.
You know, it's like.
Oh, we didn't lose much trust.
No, what the fuck? So, and then also, I just saw, caught this today, and I don't know how old it is, but I saw that the, and this is from the UK, is that there were members of Parliament calling for Assad's wife to have her British citizenship removed.
Yeah.
And do you know what? That's all well and good, but you know, I didn't hear the same outcry with regards to like hate preachers of any you know terror group.
Yeah.
So, you know, so if it's almost like continuity. You know, it's either what's good for one is good for everybody. You can't just sort of pick and choose
right,
who you
yeah,
decide
no,
that
exactly.
that happens on. You know,
yeah.
And it's a little bit that pissed me off a bit today because I thought, well, it's taken years to get people either thrown out of the country for their support of terror, you know, and direct support of terror, and then, but you can still sort of preach hate wherever you like,
right,
as long
like,
as you're not Assad's wife.
Yeah, exactly. Like that is kind of bullshit. I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure she has no freaking.
And she wasn't I mean, she was obviously she's in support of her husband, and it's not to say whether he's a great whatever he is, but that's her. That's his wife. At the end of the day, you know, you can't.
Right.
Would you think more of her if she just sort of up sticks and said, "Yeah, cheers, I'm off."
Yeah, exactly. And
because even for the stuff that he's done, he's still buying. He's Western educated. He's not a. Do you see what I'm saying? It's almost like one rule for one. And I don't really buy into that. I think it makes us look weak, actually.
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if you remove the Assad regime, there is not, you know, who are the moderates? I mean, there's moderate is very subjective in that region. I mean, who, you know.
And moderates can very quickly turn into non-moderates, you know,
yeah,
we've seen that happen.
We've seen that happen over and over again since the end of the Second World War. So,
yeah.
I think, you know, as, you know, maybe the guy has done some bad things, but to, like my personal opinion, I think we're better off leaving someone like that in power because who knows what the next group is going to look like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And then, you know, we've had then Turkey. I mean, I don't, it's been a busy week. So
yeah.
He's just, he's what, got another how many years? Quite a few years, I think, in power.
Yeah, a couple of years. He just won some kind of referendum where
yeah.
he expands his powers there. I mean, I don't
well,
know.
Obviously that would have all been above board and kosher counting.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it? I mean, you couldn't, do you know what? The stuff that's been going on this last couple of, you couldn't write it in a script, could you?
Yeah, it is crazy.
You,
I mean,
yeah.
So I just got an alert on my phone. It says, from Fox News, U.S. missile system en route to Korean Peninsula. Like,
there you go.
Like, they're just escalating it.
Yeah.
No good.
And then when it becomes like a, depending on who it is, if you think, you know, we all like to think that we're grounded and we have this, you know, we want the best for everybody. But then you look at the leader of North Korea, and I don't really see that in him. You know, you don't see. Because he's so sheltered from the world, and he's kind of in his own kind of
right. And
but
the way,
you, God knows what's going on in his head, and you could see almost like a petulant child just saying yeah, and doing something quite weird.
Well, yeah, and the part of the problem of being so isolated, like
yeah.
they are, is that again, you know, perhaps he has a completely different view of how things actually are, or he knows. And
maybe we're the ass clowns, John.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, maybe people in Korea are like, what the fuck are these idiots talking about? But
it's all relative, and it's true, isn't it? Because
no,
you would
possible.
Think
it's
that
possible.
If you're looking out, you're not looking in. You know, they're wrong, not us, and that's
exactly.
But I'd rather be us.
Yeah.
I think.
Exactly.
I always say that. You always sort of weigh it up and think, yeah, I'd rather be me. More good. Drop the Moab, I'd rather be me.
Yeah, whoever the JTAC was who called that in.
Yeah.
Probably, maybe he should get like a Moab pin or something like that.
Yeah, I wonder if he, yeah, some sort of, that's, I wonder what he's doing now. So, yes, it's a strange, it's an interesting one. And just to end on, a friend of mine just left this Sunday, Matt Bennett, they're trekking the Gobi Desert, by the way, only 1,400 miles.
Oh, right, yes.
On foot. So, yeah, treat yourselves, guys.
I hope you guys have some water, man.
I know. I was, yeah, there's three of them. So, hopefully, that'll be a success. It's all for charity, obviously, veterans. So, it's a good a good thing. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
But I think that's it. I think we've kind of, have we missed anything?
No, that's it. I think we got it all.
Yeah. That's us up to date for the week. Now, I'm sure between now and Monday, things will change.
Yeah, hopefully we're not doing this podcast from our local respective bomb shelters.
Yeah, exactly.
So, all right. So,
John, you've just put a spell on us there, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. Next you said week, it. I'm going to be Instagram living from a bomb shelter.
I hope not.
So, so I think we covered it. Now, I will play the conversation that I had with Jason Carl Fox, a former British Special Boat Service operator. And I hope you guys enjoy it. Welcome to the Global Recon Podcast. I'm your host, John Hendricks. We have a special episode for you guys as I'm here in New York City with Foxy. And Foxy, some of you guys may know him already, and he is a former British Royal Marine. And he does a bunch of stuff now in the UK with television and some other stuff. It's pretty cool. Fox, how's it going?
Yeah, good, man. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, cool. It's cool to get you on finally. So, you know, you've had a long career in the Marines.
Yeah.
20 years.
Yeah, I did. So I joined when I was 16. Sort of first 10 years I was in the Royal Marines. I went from one unit to the other unit for, you know, basically in that 10-year period, and didn't see an awful lot of action, to be honest. I did a lot of traveling around, a lot of exercises in the Mediterranean, the Far East, the States, played a lot of sport, partied a little bit. And then what happened was I enjoyed being a soldier. I just didn't enjoy some of the mundane admin-y type stuff, bits that went with being a soldier. So I wanted to continually do stuff that was essentially like rolling around in the mud and doing all that good stuff.
Right.
But I didn't want the sort of the other side of it. So I figured that, you know, going on Special Forces selection was the right thing to do. It was make or break. If I didn't make it, then I was going to then, you know,
just get out.
So that was a little bit of a driving factor. So I, 26 years old, I did Special Forces selection, passed it, and then joined the Special Boat Service, which is essentially our version of Team 6.
Right.
So we work quite closely with the Team 6 guys in lots of different deployments and also training. And then I did 10 years with the Special Boat Service, and it was literally just as the world went crazy.
Right, so, yeah.
You know, we were deploying in all the places that everyone would think we'd be deploying.
Right. So the British Special Operations apparatus is slightly different from the U.S. So when you guys say Special Forces, you're referring mainly to the SBS and the SAS.
Yeah, to Tier 1.
Right. Really. And over here we have like 100 different tiers.
Yeah, there's a lot of, I mean, you guys have got a lot bigger military.
Right.
And you've got, I think, you know, if I think I've got it right, I'd say that the Royal Marines and the paratroopers in the UK are Tier 2. And then you go on the selection process, and then you join Tier 1, which is obviously the SBS and the SAS.
Right.
And we work very closely together. You go on, you do the same course together. It's just at the end of it, you split and go to different places.
But it wasn't always like that, though.
Right? No, it's, you know, the two units were formed in the Second World War by a bunch of rogues.
Yeah,
and they were. The same, they were actually the same unit. It was just every now and again there would be a squadron that would go and do some maritime work, and they just called themselves the SBS.
Okay.
But then at the end of the Second World War, everything seemed to get disbanded, and then they reformed it not very long after. And what happened was the SAS was reformed or stayed with the army, and then the Royal Marines inherited the SBS, and they were completely separate.
Okay.
They went off in their different directions. And then I think it was, you know, there was a lot of animosity, a lot of bickering.
Right.
And then I think it was around the 90s, they decided that they needed to sort of bring everything in line. So they formed one command. That structure lives in London and it commands both units. And they're both now really sort of on a par with each other with regard to how they're structured. So you've got four squadrons in each organisation. And you sister up like the squadron that I was in. We we pretty much did lots of work with our sister squadron in the SAS.
Okay. Yeah, so I remember the first time I'd ever heard about the SBS, I was reading about Major Dalton Fury. He was a Army Tier 1 guy. He passed away recently from cancer.
Okay.
He was the ground commander for Tora Bora right in 2001.
Yeah.
And I remember reading the book, and he was in the book. He's like, yeah. And then we had a group of SBS commandos. And I'm like, who the fuck are these guys? So I remember I picked up a book by a former SBS guy. I think his pen name was like Duncan Falconer or something. Yeah. And then I read about it, and I was pretty intrigued by it, because usually, at least up to that point, I'd only heard about the SAS. Mm-hmm. I guess they have like the, you know, famous. But so you did 10 years in Special Forces. Obviously, during a time where there was nonstop rotation.
It was mad. It was, it was exciting times. I love it. I mean, I still miss it, you know.
Right.
But it was mental. It was, you know, I did multiple deployments away, predominantly, you know, Afghan. Everything from counter-narcotics to surveillance, strike, you know, going after some of the big hitters on the opposite side. And, you know, and also was involved in a reasonably high-profile hostage rescue, which happened out there. And it was that, in fact, that hostage rescue was it was my last tour of Afghan, actually. Was sort of the tour that was it was a defining moment, defining few months for me, that tour. You know, we deployed within 2 days, we went on this prolific hostage rescue, which was, it was a mental night. You know, there's a lot of work behind the scenes that went into it, a lot of other people that were involved helping us, you know, find the guy. He was a New York Times reporter, actually. Got himself captured up in the north of the country. But it was actually on that night that, it was crazy. We were getting shot at in the sky while we were flying in for, you know, a good 6 minutes. It was, you know,
oh, wow.
You could hear and feel rounds hitting the cabs. I could see the helo behind us, the cab, you know, the Chinook behind us, you know, getting shot at. You could see airburst RPG going off. I remember sat there with a friend of mine, you know, one of the guys, and I thought I was holding my knee and hurting it, and I wasn't. I had hold of his, and he had hold of mine. We had a crazy moment. But, that, and, you know, you're just willing the helicopter to land. I just wanted the helicopter to land, so I had at least had a little bit of control over my destiny.
Right, yeah.
And, yeah, we landed, ran off the back of it and into probably one of the, you know, it's a crazy firefight. Crazy. And, I was a senior guy by that stage. You know, I'd done multiple tours, seen that stuff before. But I remember running the first 50 meters, diving into a ditch, changing a magazine. And just, I remember the emotion must have been like a split second. I've spoken about it before, but I actually was in that ditch and I didn't want to be where I was. I wanted to be, I can remember thinking I wanted to be a 10-year-old boy at home with my mum.
Right.
It was mad. I was like, what?
And it just kind of hits you.
Like, I registered the emotion. It was obviously fear.
Right.
And I just had I basically had a word with myself. And I was like, all right, dude, you can't. You're supposed to be an SF soldier, for God's sake. Just get on with it. So, you know, it's like I said, it was a split second maybe, but it was something that I will remember. It made me, I looked back on that moment a lot afterwards and was like, what does that mean? You know?
Right.
You know, I was supposed to be a ball of fire and, you know, what did that mean? But anyway, right. You know, that night, you know, we were successful. We lost a guy that night. One of the guys got killed. But we made it back. We rescued the guy. He was repatriated. And it was a weird emotion, you know, flying away from that location. I remember being absolutely exhausted, you know, laid on the back of the helicopter, covered in everything.
Right, yeah, just,
and that's, and having these mixed emotions of, well, you know, we've just succeeded but we've lost a guy, you know, am I supposed to be happy or am I supposed to be
happy? Yeah,
so yeah, and then that was the beginning of, you know, a 6 month tour, and the tour just was, it was hardcore. It was the operational tempo was up there. It was one of the busiest tours I've done. we were getting into a lot of scraps, a lot of fights. We, you know, picking up a lot of casualties on the way as well on that tour. And I remember coming back, and it must have been within like 15 hours. So 15 hours from being on the ground in that place. 15 hours later, I'm walking down the high street at home shopping, and I remember feeling a little bit detached this time and almost a little bit like, whoa, what's going on here? And then, that tour, it had an impact on me. I didn't realise at the time, and then I just felt like I was a senior, by that, you know, fast forward a year, I'm a senior team leader within the squadron, expecting, or I should expect myself to be a ball of fire for the younger guys, you know, inspiring and leading. And I was having to dig deep just to motivate myself, and I didn't think that this was fair, so I sort of presented myself as a person to the sick bay informally. I wanted it off the record and said, look, there's something going on. I need to address it. I want to get my, I basically felt like I'd lost my military mojo. I wanted it back, you know, so I sort of, I thought that there'd be something that they could do, square it away, and I'll go back to work. And it didn't quite work out like that. There was a mentality of one size fits all with regards to therapy. I didn't really engage with the person that was delivering that to me. They were getting frustrated, I was getting frustrated, and it just didn't seem to work out. I was then diagnosed with PTSD and chronic burnout. And I was told that, you know, the one thing that's going to fix me is to leave the military. And I was like, no way, man, you know, this is my world. I love it. And fought it for a little bit, and then it just seemed, nothing was getting better. And I sort of succumbed to that decision, really. And I was like, well, maybe that is what I need. So I, you know, I got medically discharged after 20 years service. And the next thing you know, the following day after my last day in the military, I wake up and lo and behold, I don't feel any different. In fact, I feel worse because, you know, I've lost my identity. I wasn't part of a group of guys that I just, you know, loved and believed in and what have you. And the security bubble of that sort of had a bigger impact on me. So I did probably a good 2 years of finding out who I was, you know, thinking about suicide, you know, not seeing what my worth was on this planet, and sort of had a struggle. Fortunately, nothing, you know, major happened. I just sort of, what actually happened was I was honest with myself. I realized that I needed to be honest with myself, needed to understand who I was. I wasn't someone that was going to sit behind a desk. That just wasn't me. So then I just got out there, left the job that I had when I first left the military, and started to find myself again. And that's, you know, I ended up I knew that I needed a focus, and I'll always need a focus. I'll need to remain busy. And I think one of the things that saved me big time was the planning of a row across the Atlantic and then actually executing it and doing it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a lot of guys, from what I understand, like a lot of guys will be going through stuff. And they'll hide it because if they bring it to someone's attention, then they'll get forced out or something. And you would think that things should be done or set up in such a way that the environment would be welcoming to a guy who's saying, look, I'm going through something, you know, I need to figure it out. Can you help me? And then you figure it out and then you go right back in or whatever, right? But from what I know is a lot of guys, they'll continue on with their issues and they'll keep it to themselves because of that, you know. Yeah. And it kind of sucks because if you take the route that you took and you say, hey, look, you know, something's wrong, I need help, then you get forced out. But then if you don't, you continue to go on deployments and go through your training cycles, and you're living with this problem, and it could potentially get worse.
Yeah.
So it's like a double-edged sword, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I look at myself, and I think I'm a bad example, to be honest, because of what happened. And it was, you know, I was partly to blame, and I think the system was partly to blame at the time. You know, it was new-ish.
Right.
The management wasn't great. I wasn't being very honest with myself. I was just tired from a lot of deployments. What actually happened was I had another 6 month deployment looming. It was like we were doing the build up to get ready to go away again. I remember it being a black cloud, and I was like, I'm normally raring, you know, keen and getting ready to go. And I just wasn't looking forward to it. That's what made me sort of then, you know, go on, apart from the way I was feeling, but also this looming black crowd, this next 6 month tour. But yeah, I look at myself as a bit of a bad example, because there are guys I know that after me had ended up presenting themselves, getting fixed, and then going back into being operational. So it's getting better.
Okay.
But right. I mean, the one reason what I do now is talk about it all the time to try and break the stigma, because, you know, guys need to talk about if they've got stuff going on, get it spoken about, talk to the right people. Don't be disheartened when the first person you meet is not the right person. That's just the way it goes. You know, almost be excited and have fun just meeting new people before you find the one that does help you out or that works for you. Try and put a positive spin on things, which is hard, but
right.
But it's, you know, that's the one thing that's going to actually help fix whatever it is that's going on.
Yeah, and you know, it's every war has had. They've had, you know, PTSD. Soldiers have had it for us. Every war in recorded history, but they had different names for it. Like in World War II, I think in America they called it shell shock.
Yes. Yeah.
The Civil War, they called it soldier's heart, I think. So, and each war had its different. It affected the soldiers differently because, like you said, you know, one moment you're in Afghanistan, you know, running high op tempo, and then the next minute you're back home in a supermarket. And it kind of like, I think that that sudden switch has a certain effect.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
Know, and then the guys in World War II, they were on a deployment for 3 years straight, you know, like so every war has its like certain things that affect the soldiers in a particular way, you know.
It's definitely the case. It's like, it depends on the dynamics, and it apparently, I read somewhere that the American Civil War, there was a lot of, you know, not that it's recorded properly, but, you know, mental health issues with soldiers, because essentially they're fighting their own countrymen,
right?
You know, which can only be not a good thing, you know?
Right.
And it has that sort of impact. And then obviously with us, we're doing a lot of high tempo work in a faraway land. And then the modern age, we can be back home and within hours, right. And you're trying to readjust. There's, you know, there's a lot to be said for having an adjustment period, you know, and allowing yourself to sort of reflect, because that's what you do as a human being. You look back and reflect on things.
Right.
And for me, it was in a negative way for a long time, and I needed to sort of become positive again. But yeah, I mean, each war is, you know, that the dynamics that you see within the battlefield, no matter what year it's been or what decade or century, it has an effect on people. It's a stressful situation.
Yeah. And there was an interview done by a guy who's a Delta guy here in the States. I don't know, he had a bunch of deployments to Iraq, a couple to Afghanistan, I think, and he's very open and honest about his past struggles. And what he was saying was that it was so bad for him, the being in a war zone and then being home, you know, however many hours, that he felt more comfortable being deployed than he did at home. And I remember when he said that blew my mind completely. And I was like, all right, this is something that we have to figure out as a society, you know?
That's so true. I sort of liken it to... real life is harder than being deployed. Like when I used to talk about it with my mates, and it was like, you deploy and life is black and white. You know, you've got a job to do. There's a bunch of dudes that are trying to kill you and vice versa. Yeah, that's quite stressful, but you can almost use it as a getaway. And from, you know, the everyday trials and tribulations of life, paying the bills, the car breaks down, you're having an argument with your partner, and, you know, all those other little bits and pieces, your kids get sick, you know, there's lots of different things that play into it, where you deploy and it's just...
Yeah, that's all gone. Yeah, it's gone.
And you come back to it. Obviously, that's where it all goes a bit wrong again, but it was a lot easier. I remember listening to a TED talk by a dude called Sebastian Younger, I think.
Oh, yeah, I know.
He broached the subject of why do soldiers miss war, and it is weird. We shouldn't miss it, but you do. And then he summarizes it at the end with the fact that it's about brotherhood. It's about having a place, a belonging, an identity, and those people give it to you. by being around you. And it's the same with anything. You know, you could be in a top end business as a CEO with a good board of people around you, and you love that belonging.
Right.
NYPD, exactly the same. The fire department, you know, anywhere, sportsmen, you know,
yeah,
football players are part of a squad, all of it, you know. It gives you your identity, and then when that finishes and it's over, you crave it again. You crave, you know, what it is that you were going through. So, yeah, it's mad. It's mad trying to understand what we are as people.
Yeah, well, it takes time. And I think, like, during the World War II days here in the States, like, if you had shell shock, they just told you to, like, suck it up, you know, yeah, and it's like, you know, get on with it. And they didn't really try and figure it out. Mm-hmm. And then in Korea, I'm sure they experienced it as well. And then Vietnam, those guys got a pretty raw deal because they – so I had a guy on the podcast, a friend of mine. He was a Green Beret in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And he did his first tour before 68, and his second tour was in MACV-SOG. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, like, yeah, I've heard it, yeah.
Special Reconnaissance Unit. Mm. And it was during his second tour was when public opinion changed about the war, and people were, like, spitting on soldiers or whatever. And one thing that people don't talk about too much here in the States is that, you know, you hear the number 22 veterans committing suicide a day. But what they don't really talk – that number is actually higher because not all
– and not all recorded.
Yeah, right. They don't – all the stats aren't in from all the different VAs and stuff. And one thing that they don't talk about either is that the majority of those 22 are actually Vietnam veterans. Mm. It's more Vietnam guys who commit suicide than GWAT veterans. And one of the things that – so I have a few like MACV-SOG guys I'm friends with on Facebook, and you know they post stuff. And these two guys were having a conversation. They were teammates in Vietnam, and what they were both saying was that for them it got worse as they got older.
Yeah.
So like because it was like you didn't talk about Vietnam. Like my friend Mike Stahl, he's the one who comes on the podcast here and there. He had a I think a first cousin or brother-in-law who served in Vietnam in an infantry unit. And he said they never had one conversation about Vietnam. Like, can you imagine that? You know, like, you're different units, but, you know, you go to Afghanistan, someone close to you goes to Afghanistan, you guys spend time together and you never talk about it at all. And I think that had, like, some a negative effect on that entire generation, you know?
It's weird how the, you know, attitudes drive how people deal with stuff. And obviously the Vietnam War was something that I think, I mean, I don't know too much about it, but my understanding is that war finished and no one wanted to talk about it. You know,
yeah.
It was literally forget about that. That's something we don't want to broach. And then off the back end of that, you've got a lot of guys that were out there that were fighting that need to talk about it, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
They need to get it out there. And it's the same with it for the UK. They got him, you know, the bits that I can remember that, you know, soldiers were getting involved in Northern Ireland and the Falklands.
Yeah.
And again, it was still the old school mentality of you need to suck it up, put up. And which, yeah, I mean, it worked. It didn't work, obviously, but that's what the attitude was back in the day. But I think what's changing it is, you know, the world itself, technology, you know, it's a smaller place. People are more aware of their emotions. You've got kids that are way brainier than when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And they're like questioning, they're like, hang on a minute, if I join the military, I might get this thing called PTSD. So actually, if you're not going to address it, I ain't doing that. You know?
Right, but because you want to be taken care of if you're going to serve. You know,
because nowadays, you know, youth, young people today are way more aware and they want to know everything about everything. So you need to address it nowadays, you know, and times have changed. You can't just suck it up. You need to sort it out, talk about it. Look at how we can help fix guys and girls. You know, it affects everyone. And when we do that and we break down the stigma of what mental health is, you know, from what, you know, it can be from anything, but we're obviously talking combat. That stigma needs to be broken down so blokes know that it's all right to come and talk. And also then it's all right to start moving forward and fixing. Because to be honest, if you get through the back end of it, I think it can make you a stronger person. Anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Because you understand yourself, I think.
Yeah, and it's actually I read a book about the Falklands War, and I think more veterans who survived it committed suicide than more guys who were killed in actual combat.
There's a big fallout from the Falklands. You know, it was a tough a short, sharp war, but it was really tough, hard physically and mentally. And those guys, there's a lot of guys that are suffering that need to just, you know, have the confidence to come forward and try and sort of fix it. People, there are guys that are doing it, but I'm sure there's still a lot that haven't really made that move, and it's a shame because it will help them out big time.
Well, I think we are making progress as a society,
and
dealing with it, because they're, you know, after 16 years of war, obviously there's more and more guys are coming home and getting out of the military in the UK, in the US, and elsewhere, and so then you have more guys who are, with the connectivity of today, you know, on Instagram, on Facebook, and you can kind of get a glimpse of what it's like for them, you know? So you see posts or guys are doing interviews and they talk about these things, whereas in the past you would never hear about this, you know? So I think we're making progress and hopefully, you know, we can kind of figure it out a little bit more. So when you got out, you kind of went through your struggles for a little bit, and then you picked yourself up. You said doing the rowing. Can we talk about some of that rowing? I know you guys. Yeah. I think you guys set a world record or something like that.
Yeah, there was five of us. We called ourselves Team Essence. Stupid name, but anyway. We sort of came up with this. There's one guy, Matt. He sort of funded it. It was his brainchild, to be honest. And we were going to do the Talisker Atlantic Challenge, which is a race that they do. Because there was five of us, we weren't allowed to enter that, so we were like, well, we've got a bone, we've got the desire and drive to do something, so what are we going to do next? You know, we can't get involved in the race, so we decided to do something a little bit crazier, and we basically set off and rowed from Portugal, and we finished in Venezuela. So we were the first team to row mainland Europe to mainland South America.
Wow.
50 days, 10 hours, 36 minutes. It was
wow, it's crazy.
It was long, man. It was long and hard and been pretty boring. Well, first 3 weeks we were caught in storms. We were getting absolutely battered. We capsized 3-4 times. Ooh. We were losing kit. It was emotional. And then we sort of went past the Canary Islands, in between the Canary Islands and the west coast of Africa, where we thought, I was like, it's Western Sahara, it's going to be really hot.
And yeah.
No.
No.
There was some freak weather system had come in and was hanging around for a bit. So we made it down. I think we got to about 90 miles north of Cape Verde, and then we turned right and then just pegged it across the Atlantic. Once we actually got into the Atlantic, and we were down lower than into the tropics, it was like warm weather. The sea was, you know, clear blue.
It was
cool. We saw a bit of wildlife. And then literally just as we were getting, we sort of rode along the north coast of Trinidad, but just before we got into Trinidad, the weather picked up again and it whipped us around for a little bit, and then plain sailing. And we sort of hit land. I think late, it was dark, which was a bonus because we forgot when we were planning that where we were heading to is actually quite a dodgy area. They've got drug runners, gun runners.
Oh, so you guys kind of came at the right time.
We came in under darkness. It was quite apt. It was like another special boat service operation. Found a little beach, sort of got off, marked it on the GPS, filmed a little bit on the phones. Everyone was falling over because we hadn't walked for 50 days.
So you guys just stayed like in the boat, literally just rowing?
Yeah, we just rowed nonstop. We did 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
Wow.
For 50 days. So in any one sitting, you'd get an hour and 45 minutes sleep most, and then you'd be up again straight into another 2 hours.
Oh, wow. Rowing. So it wasn't like, it was never like any type of normal sleeping schedule?
No. We just rowed the whole way because we wanted to get it. We wanted to do it in less than 52 days. And we went for it. It was tiring. You get used to it. The body is quite quick. Became conditioned to the lack of sleep. The first few weeks, obviously, I remember looking back at like small little videos we did, and I'm slurring my words. And
yeah.
We didn't have any booze. You know, I was just too tired. But you sort of get used to it, and you know, we did it in the end. We did it for a children's charity back home in the UK. We raised, I can't even remember what the final figures are, but it's way over 100,000.
Oh, wow, so, nice.
Yeah, it was good. It was a good thing. It was hard, tough, but I'm glad I did it.
And were all the guys ex-Marines?
There was a guy called Aldo Kane, very close mate of mine, and Ross Johnson. They're two ex-Marines. Known those guys a while. And then there was Matt, who owns his own kids' care homes. He used to be a broker.
Okay.
He was ex-Royal Air Force for a bit. And then a guy called Ollie Bailey, who's still is a broker. He's a man mountain. He's like six foot something or other. Bigger than me, a lot bigger than me. But yeah, he is a strong, all good guys, and we sort of, we didn't really fall out. We just, there was a little bit of bickering here and there. But
right.
To be expected when you're living on a boat that's 8.5 meters long and there's five of you.
that's crazy stuff, man. So after you did the rowing and then you got into television.
Yeah, I got the TV stuff came a bit before the row.
Okay.
We were already planning the row, but what happened was I ended up going. I got back into security a little bit, and I ended up getting given a job to look after a production crew out in. They were operating out in and around Madagascar, and it was they were doing a show for the History Channel, and I was basically the underwater cameraman's dive buddy. So we were living in a resort on this small little desert island, and we were basically filming these underwater. I suppose you'd call them underwater archaeologists. They were diving on old pirate shipwrecks looking for treasure. Antiquities and artifacts.
Oh, that's cool.
So we were doing that, and we ended up finding the biggest bar of pirate silver ever. It was like Captain Kidd's lost treasure. And
oh, really?
That happened while we were out there. So
oh, shit.
That and then that was happening also sort of at the same time that basically the Channel 4, which is a network back home in the UK, had this idea through the production company, which is called Minnow, had this idea to sort of come up with this TV show, about running 30 civilians through special forces selection. Mm. And they were like, well, where do you find these ex-special forces guys? And someone was like, there's this dude, I think I know this bloke, phone him up, then there's like a weird convoluted way of going about it, and I get a phone call with someone saying, do you want to be, basically, long story short, do you want to be on TV? And I was like, I need to pay the bills, of course I do. But it turned out, it did well. We got a second season, we've got a third season which we shoot at the end, towards the end of this year. Don't know where that's going to be yet.
Okay, right. So
probably somewhere.
Season three would be what's going to be filmed.
Yeah, we're going to film. That's the next. That's what's going to be happening this year. I've got my own. I've got something coming up this year that I start in a month's time.
So okay.
Can't really talk about it too much, but it's going to be. There's another project that hopefully you'll get to see some stuff that I do, which will be
nice.
Be crazy stuff again. I'm always trying to do something that's going to end up killing me, but there you go.
And it was in. Filming for the show that you met Chantel Taylor.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so on the first season, she was a medic on that, and she was off. Was she on? I think she had a bit of on screen, but cool person.
Yeah,
hit it off with her big time, had a laugh, and we stay in touch. Obviously,
yeah,
I wear her t-shirts every now and again.
Yeah, she wanted me to call her the best medic in the world on the podcast.
She's a modest person.
And then you guys are also doing a fitness program going on, or kind of movement.
Yeah, there's me and Ollie, who's a guy that's on the show SAS. We've got a company called Breakpoint. It predominantly does. We started off doing corporate team building stuff that's geared around the SF ethos, how you get stuff done, determination, not setting yourself limits, going beyond limits,
right.
and pushing the boundaries.
Right.
And it sort of morphs into lots of other things. We do a little bit of fitness, we do a bit of sort of more mindfulness and, positivity around, motivating yourself, if anything.
Okay, so it's a lot of mindset stuff.
Yeah, get out of your bed in the morning and go to the gym, that sort of thing. But it's a lot of that, and it's growing and developing. Ollie's a real hard-working guy and drives that big time. But yeah, there's that, and then I've also got with a guy called Jamie Sanderson, who's an ex-War Marine Commando sniper. He's a good friend of mine. He actually left the military for the same reasons I did, at the same sort of time. We got together, moaned a little bit about the system, you know, as boys and men do.
Right.
And then we're like, well, instead of moaning, why don't we set up an organisation? So we set up an organisation called Rock to Recovery, and essentially what that's for doing, we didn't know what it was going to do in the first place, but what we do now is we've got a few coaches, and they go around and intervene with guys that have got serious issues, you know, they've stopped suicides and what have you.
Okay.
Then they talk to the guys, you know, give them some techniques to help them get through the difficult times. And then what we do then is we try to get the guys to focus on something, so they look for their rock. And it can be anything from rowing an ocean to climbing a mountain to learning to play music to learn, you know, poetry, photography, anything along those sort of lines.
Right.
And that's Rock to Recovery, yeah. So that's the other organization.
And the concept would be that one thing that you find helps you kind of get over the hump and then you
we don't want it to be like a short, sharp, go and climb a mountain, that's it, done. And then at the end of it, everyone's like, oh, now I still feel, you know.
Right.
It's more about, you know, look for something, whether it's a job or a hobby, once you've got it, you know, focus on it, you know, make that be your passion. Don't just let it be a, you know, flash in the pan, hit. Just make sure you've got something that's going to be there, you know, basically fill the gap for us or for anyone, you know, fills the gap of what's been left, you know. So whether you're a football player that now retired, a rugby player, military guy, you know, sort yourself out and then find another focus, another passion.
Right, something to kind of drive on.
Yeah.
So in the, I meant to ask you this earlier, but so in the special boat service, I know like, here in the States and some of the SOF units, guys have specific roles that they play, like specifically like in an A-team, a Green Beret A-team, each guy has like a specific role. One guy's a medic, the other guy's a communications guy. Is this similar like that, or you guys, everyone kind of goes through a bunch of different training?
It is obviously, in theory, that's how they want it to be. You've got a guy who's a demolitionist, you've got a guy who's a medic, but you there's guys that double hat as well. You get sent on lots of different courses, and so you can be a DEMS guy. You get some guys that are DEMS and medics, and then you've got the JTACs, so the guys that call in the fast air and that sort of thing. The list's endless. I ended up doing a dog handling course, so I had a dog for a bit.
Okay, nice.
An SF dog. He was cool animal. Hard work.
Right.
Looking after him, but. Yeah, so I obviously for a period of time I was a specialist in the with the dog.
Okay.
He was used for anything from detection, so explosive weapons, to protection. So obviously he could be used as an attack dog as well.
Right. Yeah, I know. At least I know here in the States there was a guy I had on the podcast who was a Green Beret and a dog handler.
Yeah.
And we kind of went into that, like, you know, how they select dogs and the whole process. And it seems like those dogs are like really the top of the top in terms of what they're capable of.
Yeah, they're mad. I'm sure the dog program now in the States and the UK is way, way above where I was. We were in our infancy. We were actually learning an awful lot from the Americans. So we'd go and see the Team Six guys and people like that. And we had an American trainer came and helped us, you know, understand what it was that we needed to do to get the best out of the animals. Because I think their program had been going years.
A couple of years,
before we sort of kicked into realizing that it was the way forward.
Right.
But they're a massive force multiplier. They save lives as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it was an amazing job. Like I said, it was quite hard work, time intensive, but it was, satisfying.
Right. So some of the, and it's kind of interesting, I'm not sure how many people are aware of this, but a lot of the American special operations, some of their unit structure and even like the Green Berets, the beret, I believe, came from the Royal Marines, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, really? I didn't know this.
Yeah, and it wasn't until I think they originally wanted the beret as to kind of separate themselves from the rest of the army.
Mm.
And they got denied, and it wasn't until President Kennedy, like a year or two before he was assassinated, they'd done a demonstration for him, in North Carolina, and then one of the guys just asked him, and he said, yeah, you guys can have it. But they originally they didn't want to do it because it was too European looking. So some of the headgear came there, and then obviously with the tier one units structured after kind of where you guys
set it up. It's a European thing, isn't it, really?
Yeah, they're
weird. I don't. Obviously, when I was in, I was like, yeah, you get to wear a green beret. And now I look back on it and I'm like, beret? Who picked a beret? Baseball cap, man. But yeah, it's mad. I didn't realize that link between the green.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, cool.
And then obviously with SAS and Delta, the founding officer of Delta did a tour with the SAS, and then he came back and said, we need one of these units here. And
yeah,
kind of how it stood up.
All right.
So for anyone listening who would be interested in, like, we have a lot of younger people who listen who are, you know, joining the military or considering it. And then obviously there's a lot of people who's focused on joining special ops. Any tips for anybody in the UK who wants to go to Special Ops route?
Yeah, basically focus on that end goal. Have it in the back of your mind. Always have that goal there. You always need a goal in life anyway.
Right.
But then push it to the back of the mind. Never forget it, but just keep it there, and then deal with every second, minute, hour, day, week as it presents itself to you, and live within your little box and back things away, embrace things. And just keep plodding on, and don't be afraid about, you know, tripping up every now and again. It happens to all of us, and it's just what makes you a better person. So don't be afraid to fail. Just remember the end goal.
Right. That's good. All right, man. Well, I just want to thank you for doing this.
No, man. Thanks very much. It's been awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. And this is actually the first time I've done an interview in person.
All right.
So it's cool.
Oh,
yeah.
Awesome. Quality. Cheers.
Yeah. Cheers, man. All right. Thanks. It was a good time hanging out with Foxy here in New York, and getting to talk about some of his past experiences and how he was able to overcome and surmount some of his struggles that included PTSD and the separation from a job that he worked for 20 years. And he's a hardworking guy; he's always working. So, just look out for some of the stuff he's got coming up on television, and if anybody wants to check Foxy out, he's got an Instagram link and a Twitter. On Instagram, it's Jason_call_Fox. On Twitter, it's JasonFox1976. With that, we'll close out this podcast. My website is globalrecon.net. My Facebook account is FBRecon. Follow me on Facebook. My Instagram account is IG Recon. The second account I have on Instagram is Black Ops Matter. There's a third account. It's my friend Chantel Taylor's military account, but I'm also on there at times. It's called Mission_Critical. Be sure to follow there. We're also on Twitter, IG Recon. I'm on LinkedIn, just search Global Recon. Be sure to subscribe, download, and share these episodes with your friends and family. If anyone has any questions, comments, or suggestions for a guest who you think would be a good fit on the podcast, just send an email to podcast@globalrecon.net. And we can do some work. So that's it for this week's podcast. We got a good couple episodes for you guys lined up. And we'll see you next week. Peace.